Another Great Depression is coming. Welcome to this audio issue of Porter Stansberry's Complete Investor, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. What the railroads teach us about the AI build-out. This month's letter is about Bitcoin. We're going to give you Porter's Bitcoin pricing model and explain how it works. As you'll see, because of Bitcoin's halving cycle, we're at a low price right now. Bitcoin is, more or less, as cheap as it will ever be in this cycle. And there's a good chance that it will move up 10x from here in the next cycle. But to understand why we believe that's inevitable, you need to know what happened the last time our country financed an infrastructure project as big as the expected build-out of artificial intelligence, AI. The post-Civil War railroad build-out was the largest private capital infrastructure build-out, by share of GDP, in U.S. history. In the years immediately after the Civil War, between 1865 and 1873, total railroad mileage doubled. In the peak construction years, 1871 and 1872, roughly 4% of America's entire GDP was spent on railroad construction. The railroads were financed, almost entirely, by debt. At its peak, cumulative outstanding railroad debt equaled a third of America's economy. Expressed in today's dollars, railroads issued about $10 trillion in bonds. The AI data center build-out is now at 1.9% of GDP for the hyperscalers alone. Microsoft, MSFT, Alphabet, GOOG, Amazon, AMZN, and Meta, META. AI infrastructure spending is projected to reach $5 trillion cumulative by 2030, per consulting firm McKinsey & Company. By the time it's completed, it will likely become as large as the railroad build-out, or even bigger because there's one very important difference between the two types of infrastructure. Railroads are primarily physical infrastructure, tracks, land, and trains, that are durable, long-lasting assets with a utility that changes slowly over time. Once laid, a railroad remains productive for decades or even a century with minimal technological upgrades. In contrast, data centers are high-tech, capital-intensive facilities defined by rapid technological obsolescence. Their value is derived from the computing hardware, chips, servers, and cooling systems that lose relevance as processing power improves and energy requirements shift. Consequently, while a railroad's value lies in its physical geography, a data center's value is tied to technology that inevitably demands replacement every 10 to 20 years, greatly increasing the capital commitment. But we need to start with the Civil War. Because without the massive inflation that occurred during the war between the North and South, the massive railroad build-out and the corresponding financial bubble would never have happened. The Civil War was such an enormous disaster it's hard for people today to imagine. 1 in 10 white men of military age in America died in the war. 1 in 5 in the South. That's 750,000 men. More than every other American war, combined. The equivalent of 7.5 million men dying today. There were 60,000 amputations during the Civil War, compared to 4,000 during World War I and 16,000 during World War II. The war destroyed the South. In 1860, the per capita wealth of white Southerners was nearly double that of Northern whites. Then cotton exports collapsed by 95%, and two-thirds of the South's railroads were destroyed. By the end of the war, the richest 10% of Southerners had lost 90% of their personal property. By 1900, per capita income in the South was half what it was in 1860. It would not fully recover until 1950, 90 years later. But for the North, the Civil War was good business. The value of the stocks on the New York Stock Exchange rose 40% annually during the war. The surging value of NYSE securities led to an explosion in listings. The number rose 10x, from 30 to over 300. Railroads were the leading industry. Shares of Erie Railroad went from $8 to $122 during the war, and many of America's great fortunes, like J.P. Morgan's and the Vanderbilts, were made during the war. What they don't teach in schools was how all of this wealth was formed, with paper money. In 1861, at the start of the Civil War, the United States Treasury was on the gold standard. $1 was a claim on a fixed weight of gold, 23.22 grains, or about half of a 1/10 ounce American eagle. Anyone holding a treasury bond could redeem the interest in gold coins. Anyone holding a national banknote could walk into the issuing bank and demand gold across the counter. Gold is hard to print. You need huge tractors digging in very deep mines. And war is expensive. The Union was spending $1.5 million per day. So to finance the war, the Union needed to create a fiat system. On December 30, 1861, the New York banks suspended specie payments, meaning they would no longer hand gold across the counter. The Treasury followed 2 days later. 8 weeks after that, on February 25, 1862, U.S. President Abraham Lincoln signed the Legal Tender Act, and with that, the greenback, the paper dollar, was born. Congress declared it legal tender for all debts, public and private. By the end of the war, the Treasury had issued $433 million in greenbacks. Was any of this constitutional? No. Article Y, Section 8, of the U.S. Constitution grants Congress the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof. Article 1, Section 10, forbids the states from making anything but gold and silver coins a tender for debts. Nothing in the Constitution authorizes the federal government to issue paper as legal tender for private debts. Salmon P. Chase, Lincoln's Treasury Secretary, backed the Legal Tender Act in February 1862. After the war, Chase was appointed Chief Justice of the United States. In Hepburn v. Griswold, which the Supreme Court decided on February 7, 1870, Chase wrote the majority opinion declaring his own Legal Tender Act unconstitutional as applied to debts contracted before its passage. President Ulysses Grant immediately nominated two new justices to the Supreme Court, William Strong and Joseph Bradley. The court reheard the question. On May 1, 1871, the legal tender cases reversed Hepburn by a 5-4 majority. The Constitution was rewritten by court packing. But the paper money alone wasn't enough. The Union needed a banking system, like today's Federal Reserve, that could absorb the bonds it was issuing in massive quantities. The answer was the National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864. The acts created a federal banking charter. To get a charter, a bank had to buy U.S. Treasury bonds and deposit them with the comptroller of the currency. In exchange, the bank could issue national banknotes, uniform, federally regulated paper currency, up to 90% of the value of the bonds it held. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? A banking system with government debt as its reserves and fiat currency as its means of exchange. Our current monetary system was first implemented by the Union to finance the Civil War. And after the war? Well, once you start printing money, it's awfully hard to stop. Treasury Secretary Hugh McCulloch had opposed the National Banking Acts. He believed paper money was a wartime emergency measure that had to be ended. His first annual report after the war called for the immediate retirement of greenbacks. Specie payments, the redemption of paper for gold across the counter, had to be restored. Secretary McCulloch began retiring greenbacks. The monetary base contracted 20% between 1865 and 1867. And, as you would expect, prices fell. Wholesale prices dropped 2.5% in 1866 and almost 7% in 1867. A recession began. Heavily leveraged farmers were squeezed. Guess what? Democracies don't like diets. Retiring all the greenbacks became politically intolerable. On February 4, 1868, Congress passed an act suspending all further retirement of greenbacks. The Civil War paper that was supposed to be temporary became permanent. And since a federal bank charter was a license to print money, thousands of national banks were founded. The number of national banks went from 1 in June 1863 to 1,968 by June 1873. In 1869, the monetary base was 70.1% larger than it had been in 1860. U.S. notes and national banknotes, pure fiat paper, made up 81.9% of it, and bank credit exploded. National bank loans grew from $686 million in 1869 to $926 million in 1873. A 35% increase in 4 years. What did all of that new credit buy? Railroad bonds. Railroad bonds outstanding grew from $416 million in 1867 to $2.23 billion in 1874, more than a five-fold expansion. Building railroads to nowhere. There are many signs of a financial bubble. Rapidly growing monetary and credit aggregates, hugely extended valuations of financial assets, and the result, huge capital projects that have no basis in financial reality. Railroads to nowhere. The largest railroad to nowhere was the Texas and Pacific Railway. It was supposed to run from East Texas to San Diego, California, 1,600 miles across territory where almost no one lived. San Diego, at the western terminus, was already served by Collis Huntington's Southern Pacific, coming the other direction from California. The business case was a fantasy, but the project was led by the Elon Musk of the period, Thomas A. Scott. Scott was president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, the largest publicly traded corporation in the world. He had been Assistant Secretary of War under Lincoln, and his chief engineer was Grenville Dodge, the man who had just built the Union Pacific Railroad. Eventually, a railroad to nowhere runs out of money. The Texas and Pacific ran out of money in July 1873 with only 8%, 125 miles of track, of the total route laid. The bond market broke in 1873. Far too many rail miles were built, far too quickly. There wasn't nearly enough demand to utilize all of the tracks at a profit. 89 railroads went bankrupt in 1873, and 100 banks failed. The New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days, its first such closing, ever. Within 3 years, 36% of the par value of the entire U.S. corporate bond market had defaulted, the highest default rate in 150 years of American bond history. When Thomas Scott couldn't sell any more Texas and Pacific bonds, he begged Washington for capital, and it almost worked. Scott's lobbying became entangled with the disputed Hayes-Tilden presidential election of 1876. The Compromise of 1877 included a promise of federal support for the Texas and Pacific, but Hayes' administration never delivered. The railroad failed. Its assets, over 3 million acres of land, were distributed to bondholders via shares in the Texas and Pacific Land Trust. That name might ring a bell. We've made a lot of money with that investment since we first recommended Texas Pacific Land, TPL, in 2010. It's not hard to find today's railroads to nowhere. SpaceX's mission is to build a self-sustaining city on Mars, that red planet 140 million miles from Earth. Musk says the cost of that mission will be over $1,000 trillion at current technology. He plans to innovate to reduce that cost 1,000x, bringing the figure down to $1 trillion over 40 years. But as SpaceX's, SPCX, initial public offering, IPO, approached, Musk publicly postponed Mars as the company's first priority in favor of a Moon City intermediate step. There is nothing to ship to Mars. There is no one to ship it for. The destination has no economy. The business case is a fantasy. But like the Texas and Pacific, it is an A-list project, run by A-list people, backed by the United States government. Federal contracts have provided 84% of SpaceX's annual revenue. NASA has invested $15 billion in SpaceX. Space Force awarded $6.45 billion in contracts in the weeks before the SpaceX IPO. What SpaceX has built, Starlink, an internet satellite constellation that generated $11.4 billion in revenue in 2025, is a real business. The rest of the $2.5 trillion is a bet on Mars, a railroad to nowhere. The 1873 to 1879 financial collapse was the world's first Great Depression, and it was global. A virtually identical inflation and speculative frenzy occurred in Europe. There, Germany had printed millions of marks to pay for the Franco-Prussian War. Newly unified under Bismarck, Germany demanded and received 5 billion gold francs as reparations for the war, driving even more liquidity into Germany's nascent banking system. This was an enormous amount of gold. 5 billion gold francs was roughly 25% of French GDP, twice the entire German federal budget for the previous 3 years combined. It was the largest transfer of wealth between two states in European history. The new German Reich had no central bank, no single national currency, and a financial system fragmented across the old German states. There was a huge financial mania. Roughly 900 new joint stock companies were chartered in Germany between 1871 and 1873. Most of them were in real estate. Mortgage banks issued bonds against speculative property values. In Vienna, a brick manufacturer named Heinrich Drasch became the richest man in Germany by selling bricks to all of the new construction companies. In Vienna, the Ringstrasse became the world's largest urban redevelopment project. 5 kilometers of new boulevards lined with apartment buildings, office blocks, opera houses, and parliaments, all of it financed by mortgage banks issuing paper. In May 1873, everything collapsed. Over 100 banks and brokerage houses failed. The Habsburg Treasury suspended stock and bond trading. The mortgage banks failed first. Then the joint stock banks that held mortgage bank bonds. Then the brokerages. By 1875, half of the 900 new joint stock companies were bankrupt. Construction on the Ringstrasse stopped. Apartment buildings stood half-finished for years. And here's the part of the story that matters. 2 months after Vienna's collapse, on July 9, 1873, the new German Reich melted down what was left of the French gold and minted the new gold mark. Germany adopted the gold standard, putting an end to paper money-driven speculation. In America, the government didn't do that until 1879. And so the Depression went even longer. The economy contracted from October 1873 to March 1879, 65 months. The 1929 to 1933 Great Depression lasted 43 months. The 1873 Depression was the longest economic contraction in American history. We've never seen anything like it. 8,000 American businesses went bankrupt between 1873 and 1875, with over $1 billion in defaulted debt by 1875. Half the railroad mileage in the United States was in receivership. New rail construction collapsed. 7,500 miles laid in 1872, 1,600 miles in 1875. 79% collapse in the largest non-agricultural employer in the country, bank reserves in New York City. fell from $50 million to $17 million between September and October 1873, a 66% liquidity drain in 30 days. In Washington, there was enormous political pressure to bail out the railroads, and in April 1874, Congress passed an inflation bill that would have raised the greenback ceiling from $356 million to $400 million. President Grant vetoed it, possibly his single most important act as president. He wasn't an economist, but he could see that without a sound currency, the economy couldn't be set right. On January 14, 1875, Grant signed the Specie Payment Resumption Act. The act, drafted primarily by Senator John Sherman of Ohio, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, did three things. It set January 1, 1879, as the date the Treasury would resume redeeming greenbacks in gold at par. 100 cents on the dollar. It reduced the maximum greenback circulation from $382 million to $300 million, in a forced retirement of $82 million. It authorized the Secretary of the Treasury to sell bonds to accumulate the gold reserve needed to honor redemption. The execution fell to Sen. Sherman himself. Grant's successor, President Rutherford Hayes, appointed Sherman Treasury Secretary in March 1877. January 2, 1879, was the redemption day. He had less than 2 years to accumulate the gold. The Treasury had expected long lines of greenback holders demanding gold. Sherman had $141.9 million in gold to pay them. But the opposite happened. The Treasury's net gold position increased on the first day of resumption. The lines were of gold holders depositing gold to receive greenbacks. The greenback was now redeemable for gold at any moment, and paper was easier to carry. After the Civil War, it took 17 years to return to gold. It took the largest economic contraction in American history to clear the malinvestment that all that paper financed. But the dollar was sound for the next 54 years. Why now looks like then? When the AI bubble bursts, and investors sell the stocks and the bonds of the major hyperscalers, that liquidity will have to flow somewhere. In the last major bubble, the global financial crisis, that value flowed into U.S. Treasury bonds, at first. But by November 2008, when it became clear how much money the government was going to print to bail out the banks, it flowed into specie, into gold. Now, when the next bubble bursts, AI, there will be a new form of specie that's even harder than gold, whose price is driven by liquidity flows. This may be hard for you to imagine today, but the AI bubble will be the biggest bubble America has ever seen. Porter has written a book, 2029, The End of America, that describes how this bubble and America's enormous federal deficits, over $100 trillion, including unfunded Social Security, are likely to lead to a financial fourth turning, a complete, global monetary reset. The world's governments have long controlled the monetary base, since 1971. They will be loath to lose that power. What will happen first is a kind of financial crisis that no living American has ever experienced. In this report, we explain why we believe Bitcoin will play a leading role in the financial order that emerges after that crisis. In this issue, we're re-recommending Bitcoin, BTC. And we believe buying it now, before the next halving, will prove to be the single best financial decision of the next decade. Where gold scarcity is a gift of nature that technology can erode, Bitcoin scarcity is engineered. Its supply schedule does not care how fast computers get, how cheap robots become, or what humanity learns to mine. That immunity is not a hopeful assumption. It is written into the code. Bitcoin is not a company. It has no CEO, no employees, no headquarters, and no balance sheet. It is a decentralized monetary network, a public ledger maintained simultaneously by thousands of independent computers around the world, with a total market value of $1.3 trillion. About 20.05 million of the maximum 21 million Bitcoins already exist. The network has operated continuously for 17 years, through wars, bank failures, exchange collapses, and the bankruptcies of many of its loudest champions, without being hacked and without a single day of downtime that mattered. Longtime subscribers may recall we first recommended Bitcoin on May 12, 2023, as a companion to our report on gold royalty company Franco-Nevada, NYSE, FNV. Bitcoin traded at around $27,000 that day. Even after the brutal sell-off of the past 8 months, it currently trades near $65,700, a gain of more than 140%, roughly 34% per year, in just over 3 years. But today, the case for buying Bitcoin is even stronger than it was in May 2023. In fact, based on the fundamental factors that actually drive its price, Bitcoin is as undervalued today as it has ever been. The money of the industrial age gold did not become the world's money by accident. Gold was the foundation of the global economy from the colonial period until 1971, the entire duration of the Industrial Revolution. That didn't happen by decree. It happened for a reason that is little understood today. Gold supply is governed by the same forces that transformed the world: industrial technology. Mining is an industrial enterprise. As industrial technology advanced, so did the productivity of the tools used to extract gold from the ground. The defining example arrived in 1887, when a Scottish chemist named John Stuart MacArthur and his partners patented the cyanide process, a method of dissolving gold from crushed ore in a dilute cyanide solution. Within 2 years, it had more than doubled the gold recovered at the mines that adopted it, and it made vast deposits of low-grade ore, worthless under the old methods, suddenly worth digging. It is no coincidence that the great gold discoveries of the era, the Witwaters Rand, the Klondike, Western Australia, clustered in precisely these decades. Gold's flow tracked the industrial economy not because anyone managed it to, but because mining was hard and grew easier only as fast as technology allowed. That was the virtue. Gold supply could expand, but slowly, grudgingly, and only at real cost, never by decree. It was a hard money base, and that hardness perfectly matched an age that was transforming everything in our world. Gold made sure that debtors couldn't defraud their creditors, while still allowing the monetary base to expand. It's an open question as to whether or not that will continue to be true in an age of limitless computer power and unlimited labor. Robotics. AI and robotics are already guiding ore body exploration and running semi-autonomous mines. Humanoid machines promise, in time, to drive the cost of physical labor, the ultimate constraint on extraction, toward zero. And further out, the prospect turns radical. The metallic asteroids that mining ventures and space agencies are already mapping are estimated to hold more gold and platinum than has ever been pulled from Earth. There's also the likelihood of new, organic extraction technologies that could, for example, separate tiny particles of gold from seawater efficiently. Advanced technology is in some ways no different than magic. None of this will flood the market tomorrow. The timelines run from years to decades, but the direction is unmistakable. The digital age's tools are pointed, for the first time, at the one property that made gold the world's best money. Over a long enough horizon, the supply discipline that served the industrial age may not survive the digital one. Bitcoin was designed specifically to maintain scarcity in a world of infinite computing power. The only asset with a vertical supply curve. Every commodity on Earth obeys the same law. When the price rises, more supply shows up. Oil at $120 a barrel summons rigs to basins that were uneconomic at $60. Farmland booms bring marginal acres under the plow. As we just noted, even gold, the most supply-disciplined asset of the pre-digital age, obeys. With gold trading well above $4,000 an ounce, the world's miners dug up a record of roughly 3,672 tons in 2025, the highest annual output ever recorded. As our friend and resource expert Rick Rule is fond of saying, the cure for high prices is high prices. It is the oldest law of economics. Bitcoin is the lone exception. It is the only asset in financial history with a perfectly vertical supply curve. Every individual Bitcoin is a complete public ledger, showing every transaction using anonymous public key encryption. That makes it impossible to counterfeit a coin. Every coin is the proof of work for the entire network. Roughly every 10 minutes, specialized mining computers compete to bundle recent transactions into a new block and add it to the chain of all previous blocks, creating a new book of life, a new, complete ledger. Hence the term blockchain. The competition is a brute force math lottery that consumes enormous amounts of computing power and electricity. The winner of each block earns a fixed reward of newly created Bitcoin. That reward, currently 3.125 coins per block, is the only way new Bitcoin comes into existence. But, note, we said the winner of each block. There's a big catch to Bitcoin mining, an ingenious way of limiting the production of new coins. No matter how many computers solve the block, the lottery only awards 3.125 coins every 10 minutes. The coins are distributed randomly in a lottery. Thus, when the Bitcoin price rises, and more miners plug in more machines to mine, the odds of winning the coins dramatically decrease. The coins will only keep arriving every 10 minutes, no faster, no matter how many people are mining. Thus, when you double the world's computer power, the lottery simply gets twice as hard to win. This is the mechanism that makes Bitcoin scarcity immune to technological progress. The computing power aimed at mining has grown more than a trillionfold since 2009. But the Bitcoin lottery has absorbed every last bit of it, leaving the issuance schedule exactly where the code says it belongs. The flow of new coins doesn't budge. Think about what that means. Gold at $10,000 an ounce would flood the market with new mine supply. Even if the price jumped 15x to $1 million per coin tomorrow, the Bitcoin network would adjust and still issue about 450 new coins per day. Total. For the entire planet. Gold was an effective monetary base for the Industrial Revolution because it maintained its purchasing power, despite huge gains to industrial productivity. That meant someone who lent a gold dollar today would see the value of that gold dollar remain constant, despite big increases to gold production. That kept the playing field between debtors and lenders level, which encouraged growth in lending and powered the economy. Bitcoin will do the same thing for the computer age. It will provide a steady measure of value against huge increases to digital productivity. As computer power increases, the amount of Bitcoin awarded in the 10-minute mining lotteries will continue to have, and have not written into the protocol as a schedule called the halving. After every 210,000 blocks are mined, roughly every 4 years, the block reward is cut in half. The lottery reward started at 50 coins per block in 2009. The most recent halving, in April 2024, cut it from 6.25 to 3.125. In the spring of 2028, the reward will fall to 1.5625. The process will continue until around the year 2140, when the last fraction of the 21 millionth coin is issued, and the cap is reached, forever. When we first recommended Bitcoin in May 2023, about 19.4 million coins existed, 92% of all the Bitcoin there will ever be. 3 years later, 20.05 million coins exist, 95.5%. Only about 950,000 coins, 4.5% of the total, remain to be issued, and they will trickle out over the next 114 years. This makes Bitcoin the hardest money on the planet. There's a precise way to measure exactly how hard, borrowed from the world of precious metals, the stock-to-flow ratio. Stock-to-flow divides the existing stockpile of an asset, the stock, by the amount produced each year, the flow. The higher the number, the harder the money, the more years of production it would take just to reproduce the supply that already exists, and the harder it is for new supply to move the price. It is scarcity, boiled down to a single number. By this measure, gold has always been the king of hard money. Its above-ground stock is roughly 215,000 tons, and miners added about 3,600 tons a year, giving gold a stock-to-flow ratio of around 60. No other physical commodity comes close, and that ratio is a big part of why gold was used as the world's monetary base for more than 200 years. But Bitcoin has now surpassed it. With a stock of 20.05 million coins and new issuance of about 164,250 a year, Bitcoin's stock-to-flow ratio is about 122, roughly double gold's. And because the halving cuts issuance in half every 4 years while the stock keeps growing, Bitcoin's stock-to-flow ratio roughly doubles with each halving, to about 248 after the 2028 halving, and about 503 after 2032. Gold's ratio, by contrast, barely moves from one decade to the next. Within a few years, the hardest money humanity has ever known will be, by this precise measure, multiple times harder than gold and pulling further away with each cycle. Yet, even those ratios understate Bitcoin's true scarcity. The largest single Bitcoin fortune, the roughly 1 million coins mined in 2009 and 2010 by Bitcoin's anonymous creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, has never moved. Not one coin, not once, in 17 years. Add the coins lost to forgotten passwords and discarded hard drives over the years, and the effective circulating supply is meaningfully smaller than the official count. This is the scarcity half of the thesis. Bitcoin is the first asset in history whose supply cannot respond to demand, at any price, ever. Every other store of value humanity has tried, from seashells to yap stones to silver, eventually yielded more supply when the price rose high enough. Bitcoin can't. When demand rises, the only thing that can adjust is the price. Digital gold. Assayed properly, why does gold sit in central bank vaults instead of, say, copper or wheat? Gold is the real monetary base of the world economy because it is no one's liability. Every dollar, euro, and yen is a claim on someone else's promise, while a gold bar is a claim on nothing. And because it is proof of work, you cannot decree gold into existence, as you can a dollar, euro, or yen. It must be mined from the earth with labor, capital, and energy. That production cost is the anchor of its value. In a 1966 essay, written decades before he chaired the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan made the same point from the other direction. Deficit spending amounts to a hidden confiscation of wealth, and gold stands in the way of this insidious process. Bitcoin also satisfies both tests. It is no one's liability. A Bitcoin is not a claim on any company, government, or counterparty. And it is proof of work. The term comes directly from Bitcoin's design, because every coin must be mined from the network with real labor, capital, and electricity, just as every ounce of gold must be mined from rock. But Bitcoin also improves on the precious metal. Gold's few monetary flaws have been known since antiquity. It is heavy, hard to divide, expensive to verify, costly to guard, And, as every government from Rome to Franklin D. Roosevelt's Washington has demonstrated, relatively easy to confiscate, precisely because it must sit somewhere. Remember Redemption Day in 1879 under President Hayes? People chose to deposit gold and take greenbacks only when they knew the greenbacks were convertible into gold. People prefer money that's easy to carry and hide. And that's why Bitcoin will become the ultimate specie going forward. That is because Bitcoin weighs nothing. It divides to 8 decimal places. Each coin can be broken into 100 million satoshis, fractional units named after its creator. It can be verified in seconds by anyone, sent across the planet in minutes at little cost, and carried across a border in your memory, as nothing more than a phrase in your head. It is the high-tech version of burying your gold under the old oak tree, except the tree is everywhere and nowhere at the same time. To be clear, we are not arguing that Bitcoin fully replaces gold today. Gold has a 5,000-year track record, zero technological risk, and the standing buyer of last resort in the world's central banks. The argument, the same one we made in 2023, is that this is not an either/or choice. Gold is the analog reserve asset. Bitcoin is the digital one. All the world's gold is worth roughly $30 trillion at today's price, near $4,200 an ounce. All the world's Bitcoin is worth $1.3 trillion, about 4% of gold. For Bitcoin to merely become a meaningful junior partner in the world's store of value portfolio, its price must rise multiples from here. The institutions have finally arrived. When we recommended Bitcoin in May 2023, Wall Street opinion still regarded it as somewhere between a curiosity and a crime scene. FTX, once the second largest crypto exchange, had collapsed due to fraud just 6 months earlier. There was no way to buy Bitcoin in an ordinary brokerage account. The U.S. government's posture was one of open hostility. Consider what has happened in the 3 years since, the ETFs. On January 11, 2024, after a decade of refusals, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, approved spot Bitcoin exchange-traded funds, ETF, for trading. What followed was the most successful ETF launch in history, and not by a hair. BlackRock's iShares Bitcoin Trust, IBIT, reached $10 billion in assets in 49 trading days. The SPDR Gold Trust, long the benchmark for a blockbuster debut, took more than 2 years to clear the same bar. IBIT then crossed $25 billion, $50 billion, and $70 billion faster than any fund in the industry's history. As of early 2026, U.S. spot Bitcoin ETFs together hold roughly 1.3 million coins, about 6% of the maximum supply, representing roughly $85 billion in assets under management. Institutional allocators, including hedge funds, pensions, and registered investment advisors, now command a growing footprint in these funds, building on a massive 2025 accumulation phase in which the ETF's net absorbed more Bitcoin than the world's miners produced in the entire year. The sovereign. On March 6, 2025, the White House signed Executive Order 14233, establishing a U.S. strategic Bitcoin reserve, roughly 200,000 coins, accumulated through law enforcement seizures, now held under a standing order not to be sold. The order's first paragraph reads, "The Bitcoin protocol permanently caps the total supply of Bitcoin, BTC, at 21 million coins, and has never been hacked. As a result of its scarcity and security, Bitcoin is often referred to as digital gold." Let that sink in. The United States government, the issuer of the world's reserve currency, the institution with the most to lose from sound money, now officially holds Bitcoin as a permanent reserve asset and calls it digital gold, in the Federal Register. The law. On July 18, 2025, the Genius Act became the first federal cryptocurrency statute, creating a licensing regime for stablecoins, digital tokens pegged one-to-one to the U.S. dollar and backed by cash and short-term treasuries. And the Genius Act was only the opening act. Its sequel, the Clarity Act, which would finally settle whether digital assets are regulated as securities or as commodities, handing the bulk of day-to-day oversight to the more accommodating Commodity Futures Trading Commission, has been grinding through Congress. The House passed it in July 2025. In May 2026, the Senate Banking Committee advanced its own version, and as of this writing, the bill sits on the Senate calendar, with the White House pressing for passage. It is not law yet, and the Senate's clock before the midterm recess is short, but for the first time, a comprehensive rulebook for the entire digital asset market is within sight. The corporations, led by Strategy, MSTR, formerly known as MicroStrategy, which has accumulated roughly 840,000 coins, dozens of public companies now treat Bitcoin as a treasury reserve asset. The allocators. The money behind those ETFs flows is not hot retail money chasing a chart. It is the most conservative capital on earth, the institutions that move last, and only once the risk of being wrong has been fully calculated. University endowments, traditionally among the most cautious investors alive, have led the way. At one point in 2025, Bitcoin was the single largest publicly disclosed equity position in Harvard's $57 billion endowment, ahead of its stakes in stocks like Microsoft, MSFT, and Amazon AMZN, with Brown and Emery taking positions of their own. Sovereign wealth funds joined in. The United Arab Emirates held more than $1 billion in Bitcoin ETF exposure by the end of 2025, and Norway's $1.9 trillion government pension fund Global, the largest sovereign fund in the world, now carries close to $1 billion in indirect exposure. Public pensions arrived next, led by Wisconsin's $162 billion investment board, the first U.S. state pension to buy the ETFs, with Michigan, Ohio, Louisiana, and Texas all reporting positions since then. And the gates that determine what ordinary investors can even buy have swung wide open too. Morgan Stanley's wealth management arm, with some 16,000 advisors, now guides clients toward a 2% to 4% Bitcoin allocation. Charles Schwab, custodian of nearly 39 million brokerage accounts, enabled direct Bitcoin trading in May 2026. And most telling of all, Vanguard, the index fund colossus that had flatly refused to let its clients touch a Bitcoin ETF, calling crypto inconsistent with its investment philosophy, capitulated in December 2025 and opened its platform to all 50 million of them. When the industry's last great holdout surrenders, the question of whether the asset belongs in a portfolio has effectively been settled. A recent Goldman Sachs survey found roughly three-quarters of institutional investors plan to increase their digital asset exposure in the year ahead. Added up, and these entities have absorbed a meaningful share of all the Bitcoin that will ever exist. Meanwhile, the miners produce just 450 new coins per day, which falls to 225 in 2028. That is the demand side meeting a vertical supply curve. So why is the price down 50%? No earnings. No dividends. No problem. To answer that, you have to understand what actually sets Bitcoin's price. A stock is a claim on earnings, so we can value it with earnings multiples. A bond is a claim on coupons, so you can value it with yields. Bitcoin produces no earnings, no coupons, no rent. Critics conclude that it therefore can't be valued at all. They're wrong, because they're using the wrong discipline. Bitcoin is a monetary asset, and monetary assets are valued the Austrian way. Fixed supply on one side, and on the other, the quantity of money or credit competing to own it. Gold's price, properly modeled, responds to the total stock of global dollar-denominated credit, every treasury bond, every mortgage, every offshore dollar loan, because gold is what all those paper promises are ultimately measured against. Bitcoin is similar, except its price responds primarily to global liquidity, and, because the marginal Bitcoin buyer is the most liquidity-sensitive actor in the entire financial system, it responds faster and further than almost anything else. But here is the crucial nuance. Liquidity sets the long-run gravity of Bitcoin's price. It does not set the price on any given Tuesday. In the short run, two forces can pull the price far from where liquidity suggests it belongs. Flows, whether money is moving into or out of the asset at a particular time, and positioning, how much speculative leverage is already in the system. Flows and positioning are violent and quick. Liquidity is patient and slow. And at this moment, they are pulling in opposite directions. The macro liquidity that anchors Bitcoin's value continues to expand. But the short-run flows have gone hard into reverse. Over the past year or so, the speculative dollar that might have bought Bitcoin has instead chased Nvidia and the AI infrastructure mania. Crypto's own dry powder shrank as stablecoin supply contracted. And the ETFs, after a year of soaking up a large number of coins, saw a surge in redemptions. None of that reduces the quantity of money in the world that Bitcoin is ultimately priced against. It simply means the marginal buyer has wandered off for the time being, and the price has drifted down from its liquidity anchor while he was gone. That gap, between where Bitcoin trades and where liquidity says it belongs, is exactly what our model is built to measure. And right now, the gap has rarely been wider. Inside our Bitcoin liquidity model, Porter built the Bitcoin liquidity model on the same Austrian foundation as his gold pricing model, the framework Kurt Richebacher taught him in the 1990s. It measures the four macro liquidity factors that drive Bitcoin's price: Fed net liquidity, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, minus the Treasury General Account, the government's checking account at the Fed, minus reverse repos, transactions the Fed uses to establish a floor for short-term interest rates. This is the actual pool of dollars sloshing through the U.S. financial system after the government's own cash management is netted out. Global M2, in dollars. The combined M2 money supply, cash, checking, savings, and other near money of the United States, the Eurozone, Japan, China, and the United Kingdom, converted to dollars, measured year over year. Bitcoin is a global asset. It responds to global money. Stablecoin supply. The circulating supply of the two dominant US dollar stablecoins, Tether's USDT and Circle Internet's CRCL, USDC. Stablecoins are the dry powder of the digital asset system, dollars that have already crossed the border into crypto and sit waiting to be deployed. This is why the Genius Act matters. Every newly issued stablecoin is now, by law, backed by cash and short-term treasuries, a regulated on-ramp connecting the government bond market directly to Bitcoin demand. Stablecoin 30-day change. The short-term flow into and out of that dry powder, the model's fast-moving demand signal. The model uses weekly data, nearly 500 observations dating back to 2017, the earliest date the stablecoin series is available in meaningful size. It explains the data with an R-squared of 0.89, meaning liquidity alone accounts for 89% of the variation in Bitcoin's price over the last 10 years. Every factor is statistically significant. One caveat that Porter flagged when he first shared this model with Daily Journal readers last month: Fed liquidity and stablecoin supply move in tandem, so the model cannot fully disentangle them. This is a young asset class with correlated macro inputs, and the model's wide bands are an honest expression of that limitation. The model is not the real world. It is merely a kind of measuring stick. The model will not drive the price or make it correct. The model only communicates, based on previous data points, what a fair price should be. Human nature, human emotions, can send markets far out of equilibrium for long periods of time. And given the huge mania that we're seeing in railroad stocks, whoops, AI infrastructure stocks, we would expect that Bitcoin, as a speculative asset whose prices are driven by liquidity flows, would be well out of its normal range. And it is. Model fair value, $136,271 per Bitcoin. The plus or minus one standard deviation band, the model's normal range, $94,245 to $197,038. The plus or minus two standard deviation band, the statistical extremes, $65,180 to $284,903 Bitcoin currently trades near $62,000, a 54% discount to fair value, with a Z-score of minus 2, territory the model has visited only a handful of times since 2017. That 54% gap is the decoupling we just described, expressed numerically. Of course, the model can't tell us when it will close. It is a measure of mispricing, not a stopwatch. It can only tell us that, in nearly a decade of weekly data, the rubber band between price and liquidity has almost never been stretched this far. Bitcoin has died before Bitcoin peaked at $126,000 on October 6, 2025, and fell as much as 53% from there, bottoming near $59,000 earlier this month, before a partial recovery to where it trades today. The selling has had a clear destination, the same one pulling capital out of everything else. The AI infrastructure mania has Chip Index's logging record-winning streaks. The SpaceX IPO is vacuuming up speculative cash, and U.S. spot Bitcoin ETFs bled some $2.3 billion in a single two-week stretch this May. The crowd has concluded, as it always does at this point in the cycle, that Bitcoin's run is finally over. That Bitcoin is dead. We've seen these obituaries before. Four times, in fact. 2011, Bitcoin fell roughly 94% from its high 2013 to 2015, roughly 86% 2017 to 2018, roughly 84% 2021 to 2022. Roughly 78% every one of those collapses was declared terminal at the time. Yet every one was eventually followed by a new all-time high. And notice the pattern in the numbers. Each successive drawdown has been shallower than the last: 94%, 86%, 84%, 78%, and now 53%. Exactly what you'd expect to see as an asset matures, its holder base broadens, and less price-sensitive owners, like governments, institutions, and public companies, absorb a growing share of the supply. The bearish argument is essentially that the marginal dollar has gone to AI and isn't coming back. Our belief is that the marginal dollar always goes somewhere else at the bottom. That's what creates a bottom. The question that matters is not where this year's speculative flows went. It's what happens to global liquidity over the next 5 to 10 years. And on that question, the math is clear. The U.S. federal debt has surpassed $38 trillion and is growing faster than the economy. The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, projects the government's net interest expense will exceed the entire defense budget every year through the next decade. The dollar's share of global foreign exchange reserves has drifted down to 58% and continues to fall. Rising interest costs, in particular, compound. The more the government owes, the more it must borrow simply to service the interest it already owes, until paying for the debt becomes one of the largest line items in the federal budget. With foreign buyers of treasury debt already stepping back, Absorbing that flood of new issuance without letting yield spiral will ultimately fall to the one institution with a limitless balance sheet, the Federal Reserve. To cap the government's borrowing costs, the Fed will have to return to buying treasuries at scale, in effect, monetizing the debt with newly created money, exactly as it did after 2008, again in 2020, and as far back as the 1940s, when it pegged treasury yields to finance World War II. The turn has, in fact, already begun. The Fed ended its balance sheet tightening in December 2025 and quietly resumed buying treasuries, though only a trickle next to what a debt this size will ultimately require. Each such purchase grows the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, the dominant input to Fed net liquidity, the first of the four factors in Porter's model. Governments with debts like these do not tighten their way out, at least, not for long. They inflate. Global liquidity will expand dramatically over the next decade because, mathematically, it must. Every paper promise that expansion creates will be measured against the assets that can't be printed. Key risks to consider. While we're confident Bitcoin's price will rise significantly in the years ahead, we also want to be straightforward about the risks. The volatility is not a bug we can wish away. Bitcoin has fallen at least 50% from a high on five separate occasions, and 78% or worse on four. It can absolutely happen again. The model's own history shows the price can sit far from fair value for months. If a decline of this magnitude would force you to sell, your position is too big. Size it so you can hold through that without losing sleep or conviction. The model has limits. Its inputs are correlated, its bands are wide, and 9 years of data is a short history by the standards of monetary assets. Think of the model as a measure of mispricing, not a timing device. It tells you Bitcoin is extraordinarily cheap relative to liquidity. It does not tell you when that gap will close. Policy can reverse. The current U.S. posture, a strategic reserve, a stablecoin statute, ETF approval, is the friendliest in Bitcoin's history, which means the direction of surprise has flipped. However, as we noted, the Clarity Act is not yet law. Until it passes, a future administration hostile to digital assets remains a genuine risk, though confiscating an asset that the Treasury itself now holds as a reserve would be awkward. And remember what Bitcoin is not. It generates no cash flow. Its entire return depends on the monetary demand for a scarce asset. We believe that demand is among the most durable forces in financial history. It's the same force that has kept gold money for 5,000 years, but it is a different kind of claim than owning a great business. Given this volatility, we are maintaining the risk rating of 4 out of 5 that we assigned in our original 2023 recommendation. How Bitcoin could easily double or triple from here? This math doesn't require aggressive assumptions. It just requires answering two simple questions. First, what happens if liquidity merely stays where it is? The model's fair value is $136,271, calculated based on existing liquidity conditions. Today's price is roughly $62,000. Convergence to fair value alone, no liquidity growth, no new adoption, no mania, is a 120% gain. A double, just to get back to what the current money supply already justifies. Second, what happens if liquidity continues to grow at its current pace? Global M2 is already compounding at about 8% a year in dollar terms. Hold that pace for 4 years, a conservative assumption, given $39 trillion of federal debt and interest costs crowding out the Pentagon, and the model's fair value rises past $185,000 by 2030. From the current price, that's a triple. Not that this forecast assumes no return to previous highs in speculative fervor, no new halving premium, and no institutional buying beyond what already exists. If any of these factors return, prices could rise significantly higher. We believe gains of 10x or more are possible in the next cycle. Why we're recommending an ETF this time? In 2023, buying Bitcoin meant opening an account at a crypto exchange, 6 months after the second largest one had vaporized its customers' money. Spot ETFs didn't exist. Today they do, and for most investors they're the better mousetrap. Bitcoin exposure inside your existing brokerage account or IRA, with no exchange accounts, no wallets, no passwords to lose, held by a regulated custodian on your behalf. Our preferred vehicle is the Morgan Stanley Bitcoin Trust, NYSE, MSBT. It holds actual Bitcoin, not futures, and at a 0.14% annual expense ratio, it is the cheapest spot Bitcoin product on the market, undercutting every competitor, including BlackRock's iShares Bitcoin Trust ETF, IBIT, which charges 0.25%. Launched in April 2026, it is the first spot Bitcoin ETP from a major U.S. bank, custodied by Bank of New York Mellon and benchmarked to the CoinDesk Bitcoin benchmark rate. One note for the self-reliant, nothing about this recommendation changes the case for direct ownership. If you are technically comfortable holding Bitcoin in self-custody, your own keys, no intermediary, no safety net, that remains the purest expression of the asset, and our original 2023 guidance still applies. To summarize the investment case today, Bitcoin is the scarcest monetary asset ever created. 95.5% of all coins already exist, and supply cannot respond to demand at any price. It is digital gold by the Austrians' definition, no one's liability, and pure proof of work, with better portability, divisibility, and seizure resistance than the original. The buyers that arrived since our 2023 recommendation, governments, institutions, and corporate treasuries, now absorb more coins than miners produce, and most are far less likely to sell than retail investors. Liquidity drives the price. Liquidity is set to expand for years, and Porter's Bitcoin liquidity model shows the widest discount to fair value in 9 years of data, a 54% markdown, just above the 2-standard deviation floor. A spot ETF now makes ownership as easy as buying a share of stock. That brings us to the buy price. We want a limit that maintains a margin of safety even if the price runs up before you act. At $75,000 per Bitcoin, you would still be paying a 45% discount to the model's current fair value. At a price roughly 20% below the bottom of the model's plus or minus 1-standard deviation range. In other words, even at our maximum buy price, you'd be buying Bitcoin below the cheap end of normal. At today's prices, one MSBT share trades around $18, so our $75,000 buy-up to price corresponds to approximately $21.50 per share. Action to take. Buy Bitcoin via the Morgan Stanley Bitcoin Trust, NYSE, MSBT, up to a Bitcoin price of $75,000 per coin, approximately $21.50 per MSBT share. This recommendation carries a risk rating of 4, and we urge investors to size their positions so they are comfortable holding through a potential 50% drop. We are adding MSBT to the exponential growth section of the complete investor recommended list. Subscribers who prefer to hold Bitcoin directly in self-custody, rather than through the ETF, should apply the same $75,000 buy-up to price. Review of recommendations, NVIDIA shifts to secure a long-term business. The narrative for NVIDIA, NASDAQ, NVDA, has shifted from selling silicon to becoming the foundational operating system for global industrial infrastructure. Following a landmark trip to Seoul, South Korea, on June 7, 2026, CEO Jensen Huang finalized a series of AI factory partnerships that fundamentally expand the company's total addressable market. A massive strategic deal with LG will see NVIDIA Omniverse used to build digital twins for autonomous manufacturing plants, while a new collaboration with Doosan Group focuses on power generation solutions for the next generation of power-hungry data centers. Most critically, NVIDIA secured a multi-year technology partnership with SK Hynix to co-engineer high-bandwidth memory, HBM, for the upcoming Rubin platform. This move effectively vertically integrates NVIDIA's supply chain, ensuring they remain insulated from the memory bottlenecks that have plagued competitors. These industrial wins provided the perfect backdrop for NVIDIA to report a historic fiscal first quarter on May 20. The company delivered $81.6 billion in revenue, an 85% year-over-year increase, driven by relentless demand for Blackwell architecture systems. Beyond the numbers, the ecosystem's structural stickiness was reinforced by Elon Musk's confirmation that xAI is targeting a massive 200,000-unit Blackwell deployment for its Colossus 2 cluster. With a fresh $80 billion share buyback authorized and a dividend hike to 25 cents per share, management is signaling confidence in its sovereign AI strategy. Despite lingering macro concerns about China, the shift toward localized, state-level AI clusters and industrial automation makes the current growth trajectory durable. Action to take. Buy NVIDIA, NASDAQ, NVDA, up to $702.46 per share. Vicor, a new licensee, confirms the moat on May 26. Vicor, NASDAQ, VIR, raised its Q2 revenue guidance from $126 million to $142 million, a 13% jump in 5 weeks, and now expects revenue to grow 26% CUCSI. The company credited two forces, stronger product sales and fresh royalties from a new licensee. The new licensee matters more than the dollars. An unnamed original equipment manufacturer, OEM, took an all-inclusive license to Vicor's full patent portfolio, covering both factorized power and vertical power delivery. This is the core of our thesis at work. Recall that Vicor owns the patents behind modern AI power delivery, and that competitors would eventually have to pay for access. A new all-inclusive license is the market proving the point. The economics explain why this excites us. Royalties carry almost no manufacturing cost, so the money flows straight to profit in a way manufactured product sales cannot match. CEO Patrizio Vinciarelli was blunt about the pressure pushing rivals to the table. Import bans now block computing systems that infringe Vicor's patents. The technology is protected at the border, and licensees keep arriving as a result. The order book points the same direction. Vicor closed the first quarter with a one-year backlog above $300 million and a book-to-bill ratio over 2.0, meaning orders arrived at more than twice the pace of shipments. That is the signal we track most closely, and it is flashing green. This news reaffirms our confidence that Vicor's factorized power and vertical power delivery patents are critical for the parallel processing revolution. The licensing engine is turning faster than we modeled. Vicor remains a buy up to $275 per share. Action to take. Buy Vicor, NASDAQ, VIR, up to $275 per share. AI capital race accelerates big tech spending. Tech giants are locked in an unprecedented infrastructure arms race, driving capital expenditures to staggering new heights. To sustain the compute required for next-generation foundation models, the industry is shifting toward massive, independent financing strategies. This aggressive spending cycle has forced a pivot in capital allocation. Companies are prioritizing physical data centers, custom silicon, and power grid partnerships over immediate share buybacks. Consequently, free cash flow margins face short-term compression, putting immense pressure on core digital advertising and cloud divisions to maintain hypergrowth to validate these multi-billion dollar buildouts. Amid these broader industry pressures, Alphabet, NASDAQ, Google, shocked the market on June 3, 2026, by pricing a massive $84.75 billion equity capital raise, including a $10 billion anchor investment from Berkshire Hathaway, to fund a 2026 CapEx budget now projected at $180 billion to $190 billion to $190 billion. Just days later, on June 5, Google finalized a landmark infrastructure deal with SpaceX, SpaceX, agreeing to pay $920 million per month through 2029 for access to a massive 110,000 GPU compute cluster to alleviate immediate supply constraints. While these moves signal a spend-to-win era that dilutes near-term earnings, Alphabet's fundamentals remain robust. Core search revenue grew 19% YoY, and Google Cloud's backlog has nearly doubled to $460 billion, suggesting that the demand for their AI ecosystem is scaling as fast as the infrastructure supporting it. Action to take. Buy Alphabet, NASDAQ, Google, up to $364.61 per share coupon. The regulatory fine lands below the worst case. The regulatory issue that has weighed on coupon, NASDAQ, CPNG, since last fall finally has a number, and the fine fell well below what the market had braced for, sending shares up 14% on June 11. Recall, an October data breach affected approximately 33.7 million coupon users and has led to a massive regulatory response from the South Korean government. South Korea's Personal Information Protection Commission fined the company $409 million, the largest data breach penalty in the country's history, nearly five times the prior record. Yet it is meaningfully smaller than the $680 million investors had been discounting, and a fraction of the statutory ceiling of 3% of sales, a cap approaching $895 million. At roughly 1.4% of revenue, about 1 year of operating profit, the fine is punitive but far from existential. The charge will pressure second quarter results, landing alongside the customer vouchers that already led management to guide for slower near-term growth. But the resolution puts a floor on coupon. The single largest unknown in the coupon story now carries a price, and the market agrees with shares trading higher post-resolution. We expect residual problems to persist through Q2 earnings before resolving across the back half of 2026 and into 2027 as the charge lapse and the litigation calendar runs its course. Coupang intends to contest the ruling. Any reduction would be upside, but Korean privacy fines rarely shrink materially on appeal, and we are not counting on it. Beneath the headlines, the business continues to compound. The high-quality logistics utility we own remains intact, down 26% year-to-date and 49% from its high, even as WOW membership recovered to 80% by April and management repurchased stock at depressed prices. At $17 per share, still under 1x forward sales, coupon trades well inside our buy-up to price of $25 per share. Action to take. Buy coupon, NASDAQ, CPNG, up to $25 per share. Nicotine pouch wars heat up. Shares of British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, came under pressure in early June after Philip Morris International, NYSE PM, announced the launch of its new Zyn Ultra nicotine pouch. The new product will roll out across the U.S. market starting this month, and is aimed squarely at competing more aggressively with British Tobacco's Velo Plus. First, it's worth reviewing why Velo Plus has taken market share from Zyn in the last 18 months since British American Tobacco launched the product in the US, which includes the three key points: a soft, moist pouch design versus Zyn's drier, more rigid pouches, stronger nicotine varieties of up to 9 mg versus Zyn that is only available in 3 mg and 6 mg doses, lower unit cost, with Velo Plus cans coming with 20 pouches versus the 15-pouch Zyn cans. Philip Morris has attacked each of these competitive weak points with Zyn Ultra. The product features a softer, moist pouch design with nicotine strengths of 9 mg and 12 mg, and cans containing 20 pouches. The news sparked fears that Zyn Ultra could begin taking market share from Velo Plus, sending BTI shares tumbling to as low as $58 per share, down 14% from its recent high of $67. But as we've seen many times in the last several years, we believe the market is once again overreacting to short-term competitive jostling in the nicotine pouch market. The most recent example came on April 22 when Philip Morris reported disappointing Zyn sales volumes in its Q1 earnings report. The shares initially sold off to as low as $150 in pre-market trading. But the market ultimately looked through the noise and saw what mattered. Earnings grew 16% year-on-year, and shares ultimately recovered to as high as $190 before retracing to around $175 today. While each new data point or product announcement causes wild swings in share prices, our plan is to tune out these distractions and remain focused on the bigger picture. That is the rapid growth in the overall pie of nicotine consumption, and pouch sales in particular. In the past 5 years, the nicotine pouch market has exploded from virtually nothing to over $5 billion in the US alone, and about $10 billion globally. By 2030, the market is expected to double in size from here, and will likely continue growing at a healthy rate for many years beyond. At this rate, nicotine pouches will soon become one of the most lucrative consumer products of all time. And for good reason, they deliver the same highly addictive nicotine that made cigarettes the greatest industry in the history of capitalism, but without the smoke or tar, and a substantially lower risk of killing their customer base. Given this growth backdrop, we believe the companies with leading brands in this market, including the top two of Philip Morris and British Tobacco, will continue generating consistent earnings and revenue growth, even as their relative market share ebbs and flows along the way. That's why we remained bullish on Philip Morris even as Zyn surrendered market share to Velo Plus over the last 18 months, which hasn't stopped the company from posting consistent revenue and earnings growth. And we don't expect this trend to end anytime soon. Likewise, we remain bullish on British Tobacco even while acknowledging the risks that Zyn Ultra may regain some of the lost market share from Velo Plus. Here again, we don't see this preventing the company from continuing to post consistent sales and earnings growth. This view was reaffirmed when British Tobacco released its first half 2026 financial update. The company reaffirmed its outlook for the full year, which included forecasted revenue growth of 3% to 5% and EPS growth of 5% to 8%. Management also upgraded their forecasts for British Tobacco's less harmful revenue to mid-teens growth for the first half. The upgrade was driven by better-than-expected performance from Velo, which gained 5.7 percentage points of market share in its top markets, including a gain of 10.4 percentage points in the US. Finally, with steady progress on repaying debt, British Tobacco's management also reaffirmed its forecast to reach their leverage target of less than 2.5x by year-end. Once that happens, this will free up the company to significantly ramp up share buybacks, which are currently running at about $2 billion per year. That should deliver a meaningful boost to EPS growth, which we estimate could approach double-digit territory by next year. We see enough upside in the less harmful nicotine market to support bullish views on both Philip Morris and British Tobacco as the industry leaders in this fast-growing market. Philip Morris remains a compelling buy at 22x free cash flow, and trading well under our buy up to price of $210.09. British Tobacco presents an equally compelling opportunity, trading at just 13x free cash flow and within our buy up to price of $86.54. Actions to take: buy Philip Morris International, NYSE, PM, up to $210.09 per share, and British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, up to $86.54 per share. Affordability continues to strain. The housing market home builders continue to face big obstacles from a choppy demand environment, driven by high mortgage rates and strained consumer confidence. Despite these ongoing challenges, Hovnanian and Enterprises, NYSE, HOV, reported its fiscal Q2 26 earnings on May 21, beating expectations. While total revenues dipped 3% YoY to $667.6 million due to 12% fewer home deliveries, the company posted a diluted EPS loss of only 46 cents, significantly outperforming the steep $1.69 loss analysts had anticipated. Profitability was pressured by a heavy reliance on incentives, which accounted for 11.9% of the average sales price, primarily used for mortgage rate buy-downs to sustain a pace-over-price domestic sales volume. The silver lining for Hovnanian lies in its strengthening balance sheet and operational resilience. Sequential metrics suggest the homebuilder may have cleared its margin trough, as adjusted gross margins rebounded to 14.3% from 13.4% in the previous quarter. Total domestic contracts managed a modest 1.0% increase, and total liquidity swelled to $442 million, comfortably beating management's internal targets. Management remains optimistic that upcoming, freshly underwritten communities will carry higher margins as they phase out older, heavily incentivized inventory. However, near-term visibility remains limited, and structural recovery depends heavily on broader macroeconomic relief for the consumer. Action to take. Hold Hovnanian Enterprises, NYSE, HOV, AI Shift, Rattles Enterprise Software. The enterprise software sector is grappling with a shifting narrative as corporate procurement teams take longer to evaluate new artificial intelligence platforms. Salesforce, NYSE, CRM, has seen its stock hit heavily recently, down over 30% year-to-date, largely driven by investor anxiety regarding how its traditional seat-based licensing model will survive as autonomous AI replaces human roles. To counter this structural threat, Salesforce is pivoting its pricing structure toward consumption-based billing, charging per automated task completed rather than per human worker. Despite these challenges, Salesforce delivered a Q1 fiscal 2027 earnings beat on May 27. Revenue rose 13% YoY to $11.1 billion, and adjusted EPS of $3.88 beat consensus estimates by 24%, signaling that past cost-cutting is heavily driving bottom-line margins. Crucially, its critical growth catalyst, Agentforce, crossed the $1 billion annualized recurring revenue, ARR, milestone, proving real enterprise adoption. Management aggressively protected the stock floor by returning $27.5 billion to shareholders during the quarter, highlighted by a $25 billion accelerated share repurchase program. While the enterprise software landscape remains sluggish, Salesforce's aggressive buybacks and high-velocity AI monetization offer solid structural support. Action to take. Hold Salesforce, NYSE, CRM. Check out the full list of recommendations here. F. Porter Stansberry and Justin Brill Porter & Company. Stevenson, Maryland. For important disclosures and disclaimers, please visit our legal disclosures page. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter & Company. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue. In addition to this issue, you should check out our top three best buys, where we highlight three current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point today. You can find the top three best buys under the Best Buys link on our site at porterandcompanyresearch.com.